All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the first episode of Money Mind, brought to you by Digital Commodities, which will now be referred to as Digi. Block height is 907.134. Moscow time is 8:66. So if you're listening or watching, thanks for being here. We appreciate your time and your attention. My name's Nick, and I'm going to be co-hosting this podcast with Braden. Braden is the founder and CEO of Digital Commodities, which trades on the Canadian Securities Exchange with the ticker DIGI, Digi. My name's Nick. I'm a Digi shareholder, a Bitcoiner, and a Bitcoin advisor, and I plan to get more involved with the company as it sharpens its focus on Bitcoin. And our plan is to use this podcast as a forum to update shareholders, to discuss ideas related to money broadly, and also to talk about Bitcoin treasury companies specifically. This is the first episode, and we're shooting for 63 minutes. So the first 42 is going to be introducing ourselves, how we got here, how we think of Bitcoin treasury companies, what motivates us to build a Bitcoin treasury company, and also to unpack some of the unique elements about Digi that differentiates it from the growing pool of Bitcoin treasury companies that are constantly emerging. And then the last 21 minutes is going to be an update to shareholders about the direction of Digi, where it's going, and the current plan being executed to get us there. So let's get into it, and let's start with you, Braden. You're the reason we're here today. You're the founder, CEO of the company. You're also the author of Money Mind, which is a great book that I've been listening to via audiobook, and it'll be really fun to unpack that in future episodes because you got a wild story behind how you got here. But maybe start with just giving us a short version of your story, and why you started Digital Commodities.
Well, thank you. First and foremost, Nick, thanks for having me here. Thanks for doing this. Pretty regular guy. That's always been the basis of my story is I'm a regular working class guy from the Fraser Valley, BC. Started life out a little early in that I had a bit of a rough go in the beginning of life, due to my parents, forced me kind of into the workforce very, very young. Got experience really early with all the trades, realized, wow, this type of working for a living is not scalable. It's a hard way to make money. So I reached out. I reached out to people that I knew were successful and that had a good quality of life. And I queried them and I became a student of what makes wealthy people go. What separates the guy that has scaled his time and created real estate and businesses and bought his life by way of putting money to work. That was ultimately what I discovered really young, was that there are people that trade dollars for time, when to me it seemed very ironic that time is the most precious single and finite commodity we have, and we're willing to trade it for dollars, which is literally arguably valueless. It's printed by governments, it's exponentially eroding. So it fascinated me. Even if you were a specialist physician making $3,000 to $5,000 a day, you're still limited to your personal time. So that became an interest very, very early. The stock market always seemed to be the place where these guys were hanging out, and nobody in my family had any exposure to the stock market, which makes me kind of unique in the market, and that most of my peers and the guys that I know are second gen stock jockeys, stock brokers, promoters, bankers. No one in my family had any exposure to the market, which made it very interesting to me. So started out in tech, about 18 years old, at Suncor, and I noticed all the guys with the 911s in the parking lot. They talked about their Suncor options, they talked about oil futures. So I immediately got interested in the energy side of the business. That kind of led to a real passion for gold and silver, really based back in 2003 on the whole philosophy of Bitcoin, that gold is God's money. It goes back. We have like 6,000 years of recorded use. It's limited. Its supply is finite. It's difficult to create. Its buying power goes back. 1 ounce of gold, for example, can buy you a fine suit today. It did the same thing 100 and 1,000 years ago. So that love of gold led me to be a small shareholder in a little company called Supreme Resources, actually out of Chilliwack, BC, funny enough. That was the first one of the first real quality cannabis RTOs back in late 2013. Became Supreme Cannabis, later acquired by Canopy. So I spent quite a few years as one of the first real sort of internationally recognized cannabis experts, ironically, as a guy from the Valley that just knew cannabis back to 1996, knew all the people, I spent a few years in Las Vegas with the very first grow there. I spent about a year in California with one of the big ones there, River Distribution, which was Origin House bought by Cresco Labs. Spent a lot of time with Aurora from inception. So I was really in the middle of the kind of cannabis mania, which was another big lesson. My second lesson that after September 2008, which is the debt crisis, which is to say that things don't always last forever. And there are manias, and the public has an amazing ability to jump in at the top, panic, and get out at the bottom. So that human behavioral psychology really became my focus. I again was really interested in energy because I used energy, really interested in gold and silver because it made sense. And then ultimately, when crypto sort of came to be, which was actually right after September 08, if you remember, I think it was early 09, Bitcoin was the first kind of rumblings. It was very interesting to me because, again, you had something that challenged the traditional central bank fiat concept, the monopoly of money that ultimately I thought had been really destroyed when they removed the gold standard. So Bitcoin immediately appealed to me in its scarcity, the concept that it was decentralized, the concept that there's no other parties involved, it cannot be manipulated, it cannot be in any way played with. Which is exactly to say how the entire fiat global banking system is. It's manipulated, it's controlled, and sadly, it's used for all sorts of heinous things. So I did, in fact, in 2017, I was part of the very first public offering in blockchain. It's called 360 Blockchain. I converted that shell from 360 Capital, 360 Blockchain. I was the CIO or Chief Investment Officer. And then, funny enough, my little brother went on to create Liquid and WonderFi, two kind of darlings of the Canadian industry. So long answer, I apologize, but the ability to kind of get in front of things, no special training or guidance, just a real thirst for knowledge. I was a real student of Benjamin Graham and of course Buffett and Munger and the value mindset, but my world was speculative and startup. So I think I had my strength was the ability to identify and understand trends, identify and understand the human behavior around those trends, but then instill a value component, which protected me against buying nothing or following hype versus substance. And all that to say, here we are today, where my true dream has been for a very long time to have one tradable vehicle, a public company being digital commodities, where I can put my capital in, put everyone I know in it, and then have a very, very high conviction idea that we understand Bitcoin, we understand things like gold. Particularly those two things, gold and Bitcoin, because to me, they kind of represent old money and new money. They're both honest money. They're both untamperable, unfuckwithable currency. They're real money. And you could even argue that Bitcoin is almost like, and Brandon from Swan said it best with an article, that it's almost like mycelium, and that it's almost the root code or the source code of something that could go on for the next 1,000 years. And really blossom into the new era that we're heading into, this digital era. So ultimately, create a company that's founder-led, high conviction. Founders have very deep, real skin in the game. It is my one and only job. I don't have other side hustles, projects, public entities. I don't promote things. I'm not a broker or banker that gets fees like many of the CEOs in this business. This is my focus. It gets 110% of my time. I've got a family and I've got this company. So the company, again, I know, again, that's a long answer for you, but trying to give a bit of the genesis that it comes from many decades of investing for a living, taking a lot of pride in that, knowing where the puck is going, being there with true belly conviction, the ability to explain why and how, and then the execution and the operational ability. To then allocate capital accordingly around that. So that's ultimately the genesis of digital commodities, of where we are today, more importantly, where are we going, what do we want exposure to, and then giving the investor one ticker that has a founder that says, look, here's what I've done, here's what I'm seeing, this is where my capital is. If you want to ride with us, awesome. And just really, hence this discussion today, a big emphasis on engagement and being accessible. Listening to our shareholders, being highly cognizant of what's happening in real time. And if anything, that's my one and only strength is a deep sort of sensitivity to what is going on out there and the ability to read the public and the ability to act accordingly and be at the right place at the right time.
Love it. That was a perfect explanation. No apology needed. And out of curiosity, I mean, you're also an author. You wrote Money Mind. When I first found out about, I first saw your post on X. I started looking into digital commodities, doing sort of research, found your book on your website, got the audiobook, was really fascinated by the stories that you had from the wild, cannabis cowboy days and how crazy it actually was. And I think there's probably a parallel there to some extent of the mania that happened back then, the hype, and probably the mania that we're about to step into with Bitcoin treasury companies, where there is substance to it, but it also has to be measured against reality and fundamentals, and not just emotion, because emotions can get real wacky. So I'm sure that living through that era and being involved in that is probably going to be a good strength for the time that you're leaning into, because it feels like something's coming like that, and there's going to be waves, and the people who can weather it emotionally and who can stick to fundamentals are going to be the winners, I think. So why'd you write the book? I wanted to ask you that. I haven't asked you that. It's like, it's not easy to write a book. Anyone who listens or reads the book, if you're a shareholder, I highly recommend it because it brings you closer to understanding Braden as the founder and the reason that it's actually the reason digital commodities exists. But you told stories about your life with kind of like intense level of authenticity, and like you really put it all on the line, and you were super, you put it all out there, which I commend you for. And you also read your own audiobook, which I also commend you for. I already told you that, but I think it deserves another kudos. But why did, what led you to want to write the book? Like, what, did you always want to be an author? What was the motivation to do that? Because it's not an easy thing.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying all that. That's incredibly kind. And recording an audiobook is extraordinarily difficult. One thing I didn't realize that sitting in a booth for 2 days and acting essentially was what was entailed there. So it all started with a very, very long, like 35,000 word manuscript, which was really like a 15-year long story of my journey in the capital markets. I always felt it was too personal. So what I did was I reached out to a guy who became a good friend of mine, actually, a guy named Jamie Wheel, who's a best-selling author with a bunch of incredible books and incredible Substack. And he finally said two things to me. He said, and this is widely known, he said, first of all, you write to teach. You don't write to educate, or pardon me, you write to learn, I guess you could say. So I went back to the manuscript and I basically whittled it down to, I think, about 14,000 words. So I cut it in half, which was extraordinarily difficult. I took most of the personal stuff out, and I almost felt like I remember hearing like Martin Scorsese makes these epic 6 hour The Departed and has to cut it to three, and can only imagine how hard it is to take your master work and cut it in half. That was actually, it took me a full year to cut the manuscript in half. So Jamie said, write to learn, for one. It's cathartic. You're going back and you're reflecting on where you made money, where you lost money, which to me was very, very important because I'd made a lot and I'd lost a lot at that point. Then he said the best part, which was write this book for your 18-year-old grandson. And I just kind of went, oh, wow. He said, you got to have an avatar. And I suggest everyone write a book, but before you do so, who are you writing for? So I literally visualized like my son's son, 20 years from now,
Cool.
and go, okay, I'm writing to him and I want to say, here you go. This is how it works. Please don't blow your effing brains out like I did. There's something called the lottery phenomenon. If you plunk a bunch of money on a fool or on a poor-brained person, that money will flee that inhospitable environment, and sometimes in shockingly quick order. And it's called the lottery phenomenon. It happens all the time. If you give a poor person money, it will dissipate. And there's another amazing saying I've heard. I don't know how true it would be, but something on the lines of, if you divided all of the world's money by its 8 billion inhabitants, it would only take about 2 years and that money would flow right back to exactly how it was. The poor would lose it, the rich would get it back. It's a fascinating concept. So in 2019, I should say more into 2020, if you remember GameStop and AMC. So that's what really triggered me, where I went, okay, now every 19-year-old in the world is a professional speculator on their iPhone using their Visa to finance GME calls. And I went, this is nuts. This is absolutely nuts. This is a true mania. This is the same as 87, the same as 08, and the same as the dot-com boom in 2000, or bust, I should say, in 2000. And so I could see the writing was on the wall that this wasn't going to end well, and that everyone that I knew was texting me back then saying, should I buy AMC? Should I buy GME? Should I buy Bitcoin? And my reply to all of them was, why? And they went, well, I don't know. Is it going to go up? And I go, well, If it does, what are you going to do? They went, I don't know. And I said, if it halves on you, what are you going to do? And they said, I don't know. I said, exactly. So don't buy anything because you don't have a plan. You want to create something for nothing. So the energy, which still exists in the market, of course, it fuels the market. The energy of something for nothing has always bothered me because I know that the greatest investing minds in the world, they bought quality. They didn't try to time the market. It was about time in the market, not timing the market. It's a very, very critical component in that it's not about trying to time it. It's about trying to be in it at the right time over the long time and dollar cost averaging whatever you truly believe in. So everyone who's a speculator in the beginning of 2020, I was going nuts. I reached out to Jamie. I said, I have this manuscript. I need to put this book out. Now's the time. I've been right in the center of this cannabis mania. I watched people full with what they call investor mania, which again, I sort of mentioned, which is that mutual fund outflows are always the highest at the bottom. Mutual fund inflows going back over 7 years are always the highest at the top. So the public has a very special, very unique ability every single time to buy the top and sell the bottom. So I myself have to fight that tendency of, oh my God, it's gone up. I missed it. Oh, it's gone up again. I missed it. It's gone up again. I better buy it now. Oh, fuck. It's back to where I should have bought it. And then you sell at the bottom. Or worse yet, people want to buy Costco shares. So they buy Costco and that goes down. And then they wait a year and go, oh my God, what should I do? Then it goes back to their entry. Then they get out at even because they're finally even again. And then only now it goes up. So people's process is wrong. It's not that they shouldn't buy Costco or Visa or John Deere or Lululemon. It's that they should choose what they believe in and they should step in tranches over time, right? So another way to put it, I give a lot of different examples of everything from cars to professional gamblers. And I figured out in my journey a bunch of little secrets. And one is that if you're a professional poker player, for example, you walk into a casino, you have a $100,000 bankroll, you sit at a table, you get $100,000 of chips. You only need to make 10 grand that night. That's your target is 10K. You need 10%. Pretty easy to do night after night if you're a professional. The amateur walks in the casino, sits beside him with $10,000 bankroll, puts it down, and he's aiming to make 100 grand, a 10 banger, and he loses it all. So trying to separate the professional mindset, acting like an institution, acting like a professional versus acting like a manic, irrational, FOMO-based chaser, right? And so when I made money, reflecting back again to the genesis of the book, it was when I bought something with a true dynastic mindset, like Anthony Deden, which is to say, I don't care about selling Bitcoin. My kids can sell Bitcoin. I'm detached from liquidity from the exit. That, in my view, is a true investment. I love buying gold because I don't want to sell gold. Another way to put it is if you buy a classic car, you put it in the garage, it's worth $250,000. If you were to sell that classic car and get the check for 250, it wouldn't feel as good as the car that's irreplaceable. So buy classic cars, buy family heirlooms, buy Bitcoin, buy bars of gold. These are assets in the true sense of the word, because unlike buying the next high-flying penny stock, you're actually buying a hot potato because you go into your brokerage account every day and you get quotes all day. And all you're worried about is should I sell, should I sell, should I sell? And the same three problems come up every day when you own a stock: buy, sell, or hold. Next day, buy, sell, hold, buy, sell, hold, buy, sell, hold. Make it easy on yourself. Find assets you want to buy and own, and then hold them and forget selling. So it's incredibly freeing, and you'll find you make a lot more money. And that was the success of Berkshire Hathaway, the success of any of the great investors of our time, is that they detached from both exit, when, the question of when, and they detached from the price. And they went, I'm buying an underlying asset, I'm buying a quality component. And again, one of my favorite sayings is that over the short term, the stock market is a voting machine. Over the long term, it's a weighing machine. Well, what does that mean? Prices go like this, but the underlying value is here. So if you're tethered to that underlying value, you care not if it's at a discount or at a premium. So that was really the book was to also explain. And I've spent a bit of time with Kiyosaki, which is ironic because my own dad, who had a successful career in aviation, made about 200,000 to 300,000 a year and died broke. He died with nothing. And then his father, a World War II veteran, never broke like $50,000 to $60,000 a year as a pilot as well. But he died with, a vacation home and an airplane and a bunch of assets and lived a very, very comfortable life because he had a very healthy relationship with money. My dad always felt like money was falling through his fingers. It was never enough. Every paycheck was already spent. It was complaining about taxes. It's complaining about this. And he's a victim of money. His father was, he had an abundant spirit. He had abundant natural gratitude around money. And so I realized at a pretty young age that wealth is a mindset. That if you realize, Nick, that I have a wife and a kid, they're healthy, I'm healthy, I have a roof over my head, I have shoes on my feet, and I'm not starving, I'm wealthy. I'm literally wealthy. Now, I should say rich. You're already rich because time and health are the real currency. Now, you're going to work on you building your actual net worth and building your wealth. But until you flip the switch of I'm already rich, you'll never get rich. And the reason rich people are rich is because they made a decision at a certain point to go, I'm abundant. Money flows to me. I know how to make it. I know how to earn it. I know how it works. I've read the books. I have mentors. I have guides. And I'm not going to treat it like I would with cigarettes and lottery tickets. And I'm not going to disrespect that energy. Like the Tao always talks about how money is water. It flows, liquidity. Banks are literally
The
the
banks of
bank
a
of a river
river.
flows the water and different branches of a bank. I mean, you can tie all monetary things to liquidity, to water, fascinatingly enough. And water has energy, water flows, and water's effortless. Water moves silently and it moves the same every way and it moves without effort. So allow your money to flow, acknowledge that you're already rich. And that's all the book is to say money is abundant. You can make money 10 million different ways. Time is not, health is not. The real money is buying yourself a runway, learning how to trade on paper, finding instruments that you love and excite you. And yes, you can trade. I love to trade. I don't do it much anymore, but I do love the act of trading. But that's a hobby. That's not a way to make money. If you're a great trader, as a byproduct, you will make money. But there aren't any billionaire day traders. That's a fact, unfortunately. There's only guys that sell courses, right? So the billionaires are high conviction, buy it and put it away. I'll check it in 10 years. The Uber billionaires are buy it and my grandkids will sell it. That's the difference. So invest dynastically, buy things you don't have to worry about selling. Understand that the more you move, that goes against you by way of spreads, fees, all sorts of different erosion of your capital, the more active you are. Berkshire makes like two trades a year, right? The average penny stock trader probably makes 10 or 20 a day. I know many that do more than that, and they might carve out a couple hundred a year, but they spend 12 hours a day thinking about tickers. So
So they're
achieve
time
what you
poor.
want to be, but ultimately buy a runway, which is to say, if you need 200 grand to live, get that 200, sit back, look down from 30,000 feet. What do you want to do? What do you want to be? And make a decision because you can do anything. When Kid Rock, give that example, when he decided to be the biggest, baddest mother effer on the planet, he told the world that, and guess what? They said, okay. And Oprah Winfrey, she was just a cringy rookie. And she was nobody. And she said, I'm going to be the best. The world said, okay. So, whether Henry Ford, a great world famous saying, whether you think you can or think you can't, you are correct. So, if you want to be a world class speculator, you can. I'm proof of that. If you want to be a day trader, you can. And if you want to be a full time investor, you can. And you can start with 5 or 10 grand if you follow the rules of the professionals. And again, long answer, but I hope it gives a
It's okay.
background. And the book, I will just finish and say it is available in all formats. And for anyone that can't afford the book, I will gladly email them a PDF just so that people can get it. Because that it wasn't done for monetary purpose. It was a guide or a manual to say, I fucked up. I also made millions, and I don't want you to lose money because the gut-wrenching feeling of losing 5K is bad enough. And I've had leverage options trades worth over 1.5 million USD expire on me. That's a slow motion gut rot like you wouldn't believe. So don't make stupid decisions. Money is real, but it's just energy, and that's the whole book.
Love it. So you had a manuscript, you saw the mayhem, the mania. You realized that now's a good time for the world to have access to a book that brings reason to investing. So thank you for writing it. And I think on these Money Mind episodes, we'll be able to sort of unpack sections of the book, topics that you've written about. We'll share some stories because I think you got some wild stories in there that are worth sharing. Thanks for that. My story, very brief. As I said, I'm a Digi shareholder. I'm also a Bitcoiner. I think in a future episode, maybe we share our definitions of Bitcoiner because it means a lot of different things to different people, but I have a pretty clear definition. I started learning about Bitcoin in late 2015, My background is actually as a health professional, specifically with lower body musculoskeletal health. That's where I specialized. I actually heard about Bitcoin from a patient. It was a software programmer that had shoulder problems because he's at a computer all day, wouldn't stop nagging about Bitcoin. I finally looked into it, got some, and it just sucked me into its orbit. I'm super curious. And so it's been this endless rabbit hole. I frankly, I didn't have time to veer off into shitcoins. I didn't have time to veer off into other things because I was fully consumed by Bitcoin. And the only other notable thing in my story is that I helped raise sats and personally handed those sats out to truckers during the Freedom Convoy. So that was a pretty special moment in my life. I'm just fascinated by Bitcoin, and contributing to accelerating the transition from fiat to Bitcoin is super meaningful to me, and that's why I'm here. And I want to support teams and be part of a team that's helping to accelerate that transition because it cannot come soon enough. There needs to be a lot of us that are helping to get us there quickly and in a way that's sustainable. So maybe the next good question to dive into is how, just from a zoomed out level, without getting too granular, how do we actually think of Bitcoin treasury companies? Because these are a pretty new thing, right? Bitcoin's not new now, but Bitcoin treasury companies specifically, from the inception with Strategy, are actually pretty new. So I think a good maybe question prompt is, how do you explain a Bitcoin treasury to someone who knows nothing about Bitcoin, maybe has heard the word, but really hasn't done any work to understand it, and to someone who is also unfamiliar with the word treasury? So, I'm curious to see how you would do that, and then I kind of have some thoughts about how I think of a Bitcoin treasury company. But yeah, how do you explain a Bitcoin treasury to someone, or a company that is holding a lot of Bitcoin? It might not be just pure, but the majority of their focus or most of their focus is on Bitcoin. How do you explain that to someone who knows nothing about it?
Yeah, that is the question, and I'm excited to hear your answer as well. A publicly traded vault, a place where someone can gain proxy or exposure to probably one of the most important assets of our life. A company that's cognizant of the fact that, as I said, fiat is eroding in real time. The real inflation or the real tax is inflation. Arguably, dollars are losing power every year. I mean, they are. It's not a secret. They're literally losing power. So a treasury company is really a company that is highly cognizant of the fact of where we're going. They're aware that holding a real currency or real asset on the balance sheet opposed to fiat is a very, very easy decision to make once you're educated. A company that recognizes that you can convert something arguably useless, i.e. USD or CAD, into something highly valuable, aka BTC. A company that recognizes that you can scale that model by way of accessing more fiat, convert more fiat to BTC. And that company recognizes that if you fast forward 10 years from now, the high probability, as John McAfee said to me personally, was that if Bitcoin goes to 100,000, it's probably going to see a million. That's just the math and the mechanics of it, as it were. So public companies, there's a lot of great descriptions out there. I'd encourage people to go on Twitter and look at some of the definitions and some of the whys as why you get premiums on MNAV, for example. But ultimately, they can go to market, they can raise capital. So they have leverage. They have the ability through debt, through equity, through other means to get larger pools of capital to where you as a singular investor might still actually get more exposure sat per share, if that makes sense. You might actually have be your fractional pro rata ownership, not just today, but 5 and 10 years from now, could end up being levered more than you just going into Coinsquare or Coinbase and buying it yourself, which of course is great. And there's all sorts of debates on your own personal custody, which I of course recommend. But the ability to take part in a much larger, steam engine that's going down the track that has the ability to bolt in cash, and that snowball effect, or that again, the leverage, the crowbars in effect, that has the ability to rapidly buy more. If you take a MicroStrategy as an example, I mean, if they end up with 5% of the supply, 10% of the supply, another couple of companies get 1 or 2% of the supply, the writing is on the wall with only 21 million in total circulation, obviously less than that in real circulation. There will be a crunch. There will be serious tailwind or upward pressure on the underlying asset price in fiat, not to mention the fact that governments over the last 6 years have printed more dollars than they have in the last, I believe, about 100 prior to, from about 2019. They've doubled the monetary supply. So arguably, that jug of milk that now costs double it did in 2018, 2019, it's not worth double. It takes twice as many dollars to buy it. The house you're in that's worth $1 million you paid 250 for isn't worth more. It takes more dollars to buy it. So gold fixes that in a sense, again, that gave the example, the single coin's buying power. 250 years ago, you could buy a suit of armor for that singular gold coin. So its single individual buying power has maintained through the millennia. That is, I believe, what Bitcoin is going to do. And as long as nothing is jeopardized, then it has no room to go but up. And so a treasury company is a company that's looking forward, plain and simple. And I think you're going to see even some of the world's biggest mining companies, eventually they'll start to say, well, we have 100 million, 200, 300 million in cash. We're literally losing value, losing buying power every year. And you're going to start to see them even rolling capital or you could say fiat currency into BTC as well. So again, convoluted answer. Love to hear yours. Hope that makes sense.
I like it. That was a good answer. I mean, my favorite part of all that is Bitcoin Treasury Company is a company that's looking forward. And I
Yeah.
think, the old saying of we used to call certain companies internet companies, companies that were on the internet or working, on that protocol layer when it was new. And now, if you're not an internet company, you really probably don't exist because every company's an internet company. And I think there's going to be a similar transition with Bitcoin. Every company is going to need to have a Bitcoin treasury if they want to survive. It's like, don't go out of business insurance. Everyone's going to find out eventually that that's what they need. Their primary focus might not be on that. They might be an operating business, but if they don't have a Bitcoin treasury, I think they're just going to get bled dry and not be able to compete. I think my favorite metaphor, I mean, just to zoom out, I think fiat currency is a parasite that's basically making civilization sick. And Bitcoin is the medicine to purge that parasite so that humanity can actually flourish. And to me, owning shares in a Bitcoin treasury company is a vote against fiat and for Bitcoin. And if you choose the right team, you might end up with more Bitcoin than you started with, which means you made a good investment. And I think a simple metaphor for me when it comes to how I think about treasury companies is I think of a Bitcoin treasury company as a transformer. That is receiving fiat currency, transforming it into Bitcoin, and sending it to a vault protected by encryption. And an electrical transformer, if anyone's familiar with that, those little cans that you see on light posts, and if you go to a big power station, they're real big machines, essentially converts a certain voltage of energy, steps it down to another voltage that can then be fed to houses. So it just transforms electrical energy from one state to another state. And I think in this metaphor, it's a capital transformer. It's transforming capital from fiat currency, which, like you said, is worthless and becoming exponentially more worthless, into Bitcoin. And each shareholder, if digital commodities is a capital transformer, each shareholder owns a small piece of that transformer and owns their share of sats in that vault that the sats are being sent to. So, as an investor, as someone who takes a small amount of my net worth to, invest in publicly traded businesses as sort of a way to keep a pulse on the Bitcoin community, and also, frankly, as a vote to vote for teams that I think are doing good work and are helping us accelerate the irrelevance of fiat. The thing I care most about is the number of sats per share and the rate of growth of those sats. So, how fast are sats getting added to each share, and how many sats does each share represent? And that means I frankly don't mind if the shares are diluted as long as the number of sats I own per share is increasing. I don't care if the fiat price goes down, so long as the number of sats per share is increasing. And if that does happen, where fiat price goes down, sats per share goes up, that just means a bigger discount where I want to buy more. And the only reason I would invest in a Bitcoin treasury company instead of buying cold hard sats and cold storage is I'm expecting the number of sats I own as part of that company per share to grow at a competitive rate, which is more attractive than just sats in cold storage, which I think is the de facto standard. And you should have that first, and everyone should learn how to hold their own keys. But I also think that ownership in a treasury company has a place for people who are interested. And yeah, I think the capital transformer metaphor is a good one because someone who knows nothing about Bitcoin, nothing, hasn't even heard the word treasury, can make sense of, okay, you're building a business, it's a machine, it's a transformer, it's sucking in fiat, it's converting it to Bitcoin, putting it in a vault, and if I own a piece of that transformer, I own my pro rata portion of the sats in that vault, and I own a little piece of that transformer. And me investing in that transformer is a vote to say, I like this team, I like what they're doing, I want to accelerate the irrelevance of fiat. And that's just one way to do it. So that's how I think of it.
That's brilliant. Can I add an interesting piece you said there, that there's a
Please do.
the most important piece, which is sats per share, I think is really fascinating here, because as the company increases the share count to get more dollars, be it through debt conversion or equity offerings or even warrant exercise, if Bitcoin continues to perform, there'll be a separation, there'll be a bifurcation where the sats per share starts to outgrow. And again, you're receiving more sats per share, assuming the company is making the right decisions. That is the upside. That's what's appealing overall to a treasury company. And the alternative to that, I'll give another example I just thought of, is that when you look at a mining exploration company, if you look at a company that's developing an ore body of gold in the earth, they have 100 million shares out. They go raise a bunch of money because they know that the PEA says there's 1 million ounces of gold, so it's worth X amount of dollars. So they raise money. They essentially have a fuse there, because as they have to raise to get bigger, raise to get bigger, raise to get bigger, you're ultimately racing against time and money, because to continue to grow, you need to continue to raise. So you need to grow quicker in the ore body, in the gold in the ground, than every dollar you raise, dollar for dollar. And that's why, frankly, a very large percent of junior exploration companies fail, is because they're raising to grow, raising to grow, raising to grow, and then they separate. And again, they get more expensive, and they separate from the value of the underlying asset. Whereas in this case, I think we have a diversion of that. I think we have an opposite scenario where the underlying asset is growing. So as long as the share creation, or the dilution, as to use that word, is slower than the internal NAV value creation or growth, you have something that could be really beautiful in a few years from now. So.
And it really flips traditional thinking on its head. Like, you have to fundamentally look at the world through the lens of sats as your unit of account, which is a very, like, it takes a while to get there. It's like literally a inversion of reality as it exists today. And I think for someone who's a seasoned investor, that's probably actually a harder conversion. It's a harder bridge to cross sometimes, because you have all this data and potentially all this money you've made by thinking a certain way. Whereas with someone who's literally coming at it from first principles without a history in traditional finance, they might be able to make sense of it if they really understand Bitcoin deeply and understand that the money is Bitcoin, the unit of account is sats, everything else is just manipulated numbers. So it'll be interesting. I mean, I think with Digi, really we want shareholders who have deep conviction, who are HODLers, and who understand that, and who see the fiat price going down per share, and who see the sats per share going up and are happy, as opposed to people who, when the share price goes down, get all upset. It's like, well, if the actual value per share is going up, you should be happy, regardless of the fiat price. The fiat price is a distraction, frankly. It is a factor, but
Temporary unit of measurement that isn't necessarily one rooted in reality, right? It just
exactly.
depends. Yeah.
So next thing I think would be good to talk about is, what motivates us to own and to grow a Bitcoin treasury company? Like, why do you care about this specifically? Why a Bitcoin treasury company? Why are you putting your money and time here? I'd love to hear just sort of, your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think again, you could almost argue that there are healthy cults out there. Cult is often like a bad word, of course, but it's not a bad word. There's all sorts of cults, good cults, ethical cults, and there's bad cults. One thing
Cult
I've
is just
noticed,
short for culture. So, yeah.
precisely, that's my point. So the culture in and around Bitcoin is super unique. So if you go back to 2015, when you were kind of introduced to it, there's this, what I've noticed, and I'd love your thoughts on this, is there's this sort of three-part cycle since 2015, which is Bitcoin rallies, people get interested, altcoins rally, ETH, all the competitors, all the crypto, they rally, everybody starts to go, oh, where should I be? Then you get the shitcoin rally, and then all of a sudden everyone's talking about Fartcoin and Millennia Coin. Then it all crashes, and then it goes right back, and then Bitcoin rallies again. And what's unique about the Bitcoin people, they never sold in the first place. So the ETH and the XRP crowd and the Solana crowd that all shifted to Fartcoin, they're not investors. They're FOMO speckers, right? So I've noticed this: Bitcoin, altcoin, shitcoin, back to Bitcoin, altcoin, shitcoin. I think right now, today, we're in phase two of another one of those cycles, where now Ethereum treasuries are topical. Why? Because Bitcoin has done so well the last couple of months. this year, frankly. I think that will bring in another alt season, unfortunately, this year, where we'll get back on pump.fun and all of the absolute horseshit places, frankly, and start specking on all the lottery ticket crypto stuff. But all the while, the culture of Bitcoin is steadfast. They're the actual diamond hands that the AMC and the GME shareholders wish that they had. So it is the rock, it is the foundation, it is the silent killer in a sense that it has to sit back. It doesn't have to prove anything. It just inherently is. It has inherent value. You can burn all the ETH you want in the world. As long as you have the float you have, the valuation is going to be somewhat subjective, or to say it's only greater fool theory, it's only worth what other people are willing to pay for it. Bitcoin is measured a little bit differently. I think the reason gold is 3,500 USD an ounce, other than many obvious dollar factors, and it could be a lot higher, is because if you go to the earth and you try to extract an ounce of gold, it's going to take you, believe it or not, roughly $3,000 of man hours to pull an ounce of gold when you really distill it right down. So Bitcoin's value, I believe, is tethered in something quite tangible and real. I think everything else is crypto. I think that what I just personally, is my personal humble opinion, people that truly know, that truly study and truly, I don't know if admire is the right word, but certainly believe in Bitcoin. And I'll use my brother as an example. I adore their conviction because it is unwavering. It is unconditional. And that's special. And the only other time I've seen that is with gold bugs, frankly, or gun nuts, or religious people, or people that are, no matter what, it's this and everything else. And the fact that it's Bitcoin and everything else, to me, makes Bitcoin special, makes it unique, and makes it probably a permanent fixture because it has a culture around it, a real culture, not a fickle, conditional culture. And that to me is all the difference.
I agree. I think there's a lot of subcultures within Bitcoin. And every Bitcoiner has their own strong opinions. If there's one thing I found that's similar amongst Bitcoiners, they think for themselves and they're stubborn as fuck, which makes for really good faith, productive disagreement. When people actually have ownership of their time and the time to actually learn about the world, about philosophy, about money, economics, health, these conversations that I have with these people are just so rich compared to the average person who has no bandwidth to learn about anything because they're just trying to, keep up with the fiat hamster wheel. And I think I feel like every time there's a mania, there's going to be fart coins. There just will be, because there's always going to be people trying to arbitrage the trend and take advantage of people who don't understand Bitcoin and think they miss Bitcoin, so they need to go on something else. I also think that every single cycle that happens, those people all get burned. And once burned, it hones their focus to what matters, to what survives, which is Bitcoin. And so each cycle, you have a new batch of people coming in, touching the stove, getting burned, realizing Bitcoin is where it's at. They join Bitcoin, they harden on Bitcoin, they focus on Bitcoin, they become the people who are buying, never selling. Some would argue that the next altcoin cycle could be companies jumping on the Bitcoin treasury company wave and trying to make a pump from an announcement. And there probably will be some element of that, it's just human nature. But I also think in the end, like you said, fundamentals are what lasts the test of time. And the companies who are responsibly stacking Bitcoin in as fast and as responsible a way as possible are going to be the ones that end up weathering the emotional storms, weathering whatever dips we have, and succeeding long term to be the only companies valuable enough to want to own. I don't care what a company is worth in terms of market cap. I care how much Bitcoin there is on the balance sheet. And the reality is, Digital Commodities owns more Bitcoin than the Mag 7, if you compare Bitcoin on the balance sheet. And that's a crazy thing to say. That's a crazy thing to
Wow.
say. I just want to put a pin in that. I don't think it's going to be like that forever. I think they're going to come in aggressive when they realize that not coming in means your job is at risk. If you're the CFO, it goes from career risk going into it to now career risk having to explain why you're not in it. And that's a quick transition, I think. So,
The great saying will take place there as well, which is you pay the price that you deserve,
yeah,
right?
everyone gets sats for the price they deserve. And the Mag 7 might pay real expensive pesos, dollar pesos, for their sats, and that's how it should be. But to bring it back to the question, what motivates me to own and be part of a Bitcoin treasury company? According to the transformer metaphor, a Bitcoin treasury company sucks in fiat, converts it to Bitcoin, meaning that it de-energizes fiat and it energizes Bitcoin. And I have a competitive nature, so part of me wants to get into the ring and compete and put my Bitcoin knowledge to work and work with a team of cool people that is like my second family. And I want to build a hyper efficient transformer as a way to help accelerate the irrelevance of fiat. I have a daughter. I want her to grow up in a better world. I want her to grow up in a world of truth and freedom instead of lies, deception, and tyranny. And so being part of this and helping to build and accelerate that transition phase shift, that's my motivation. That's why I'm here.
I love that. I love that. The backstory is important. The why is critical. The
I think
why
that's
is
what people want to know. If you're watching this and you're a, don't buy Digi, study Digi first. And if you think it's a good investment, buy it. If you're a trader, don't buy it.
And that is,
But
I would say, the single most important thing. Never buy anything because you heard it's a buy. Buy it because you just spent 10,000 hours studying it and you're so convinced that you have to own it that you sell yourself on it. Those are the things that you buy. The things that you're deeply, intimately familiar with, and you can explain in 30 seconds or less exactly why you own it.
Agreed. Let's talk about the unique elements of Digi. So there's a lot of treasury companies popping up like mushrooms. There's going to be way more of them popping up. Every company will eventually be a treasury company to some extent. But what sucked me into Digi from that first post on X and doing some research was that there were some really unique elements about Digi that differentiates it from the growing pool of Bitcoin treasury companies. So I'd love to hear from you, from your perspective as the founder and CEO, what features of Digi are unique when compared to sort of the landscape of Bitcoin treasury companies? And then I can kind of share my perspective as well if I have anything in mind that you didn't mention.
Yeah, so I guess I'll start by saying let's compare apples to apples. So we're not going to compare us to Metaplanet. We're going to compare us to the peers, the comps that exist in the Canadian landscape. First and foremost, we are founder-led. We've used that term before. That's a very important thing to say because statistically speaking, when you bet on founders that are all in and that are down with the ship, you do have a better likelihood of success because when you see a lot of the CSE listed and the venture listed companies as well, these are often installed CEOs that were planted by founders. Those founders are not on any public documentation. That's a reality. I'm sure it's the same in Silicon Valley and Wall Street. But the truth of the matter is that myself, my partners, and our board, we are the founders of the company. We are the largest shareholders of the company. I, as the CEO of the company, again, I've said this before here, but I am 100% focused on this company, period, end of conversation. I've bought 20 million shares. I have a hard actual CRA cost base of 9 cents. That's almost a $2 million investment for me in the company. Why is that important? Is that almost all, again, of our peers, that's not the case. They either have a small amount of insider ownership or that ownership was granted them through RSUs or stock options, things like this. That is not the case in this company. I took the vehicle over, I cleaned it up, I put the money in, I've led on every financing myself. I bought in the market since day one, literally, if you go back on SETI. I'll continue to do as capital allows. I will support it, I will do whatever it takes. So there's a high, again, I don't want to keep saying conviction, but there is a underlying spirit and energy and life force that is the founding team that cares. We have a very, very lean and effective board of directors. The two independents, Ken and Alyssa, are real people. They're amazing business people. Again, they're not promotional. They're not bodies put on a board. They're real, incredibly value add, incredibly engaged, honest, sincere entrepreneurs. My business partner, Josh, phenomenal guy. I've grown up with, worked with him for many, many years. He's the president of the company. Our CFO, Lachlan, is unbelievably capable. And that's it. That's a lean team to say that we not only have an extraordinarily lean team by design, we don't have management contracts. So this is the opposite of a enrichment company to say that most of these operators out there, and again, I'm generalizing, I'm being a little mean, but they step in, they go, what's in it for me? They take a big fee. They have an agreement if they ever get taken out that they get these golden parachutes. They grant RSUs constantly, which is free stock. They get juicy option issuances. You're not going to see that here. We don't have any offices. We're a virtual business, again, just to cut down costs. We don't even expense the travel that I do or the meals that I do. I literally, and this is, corny, but it's the truth. We don't expense things like that. So in other words, we truly treat the business like we treat our own treasury. The company now, since digital commodities exists, has more in net asset value than we raised. That's extraordinarily unusual. Most companies have a certain element, of course, of burn to be public. You have a lot of audit fees and accounting fees, and then you have your legal is crazy in this business. But the money we've raised to date so far in this company, we have in hard value on the balance sheet. More importantly for me is we have zero debt. We don't even have a large payables month to month. We have our legal and accounting, but we don't have accrued up accounts payable. We don't have debt, long or short term. We don't have any debentures against it. We don't have any future escrow unlocks. We don't have any future PPs coming unlocked. All we have is a transparent cap table. We've got warrants at 10 cents and 15 cents, which is kind of like a baked-in financing. Once the snowball gets going, we can then, without having to go to market, utilize those warrants to continue to bolt on more Bitcoin. So I think the structure is really lending itself. It's kind of like a blank canvas, right? We've got a relatively small market cap. We have a committed founder-led team with skin in the game. I have 20 years to prove myself out here. I'm not here for, a lot of the penny stocks, to use that horrible term, that I've invested in. When they failed, the management went, well, not all things work out. That's venture capital. On they go to the next seven tickers that they own. Not the case here. If this fails for me, this is not a good situation. So I'm a little more motivated. You could say that I'm aligned with shareholders a lot more than any comp that you can show me on the board. Our relative value or our NAV relative to market cap, I would say, is arguably probably one of the closest. So in other words, in the event of a really bad market downturn, we probably, I can't say this, but we're probably relatively insulated from how far could we go if the market falls apart tomorrow. You got to look at worst case scenario. If we have another September of 2008 where everything halved, without justification, what are you going to do, right? Ford came down to like a dollar or two in October of 2008, and then by January, February, I think it was back up to like 12 or 15 bucks. So things move, and while we're a volatile stock, I'd like to think that we are, again, one that's managed well. Management cares, management is convicted, management will support. Management are real people, they're transparent people. Our board cares, and it's small, and we don't have the excess fat or burn, or any of the sort of, let's call it, Vancouver or Howe Street or Bay Street penny stock fuckery, frankly, that I warn a lot about in my book and that I'm really disgusted by, because I didn't come to the market by way of the penny stock game. And again, I will just go out and say it and get a lot of hate for it, but the majority of penny stock operators come from the penny stock brokerage business. They understand that side of the business, and they understand all the things you can do with these securities lawyers in Canada, which is to say they get away with murder. And unfortunately for us, we bought our stock and all the stocks in our name. And I hate to even state the obvious, but like, that's sadly rare. That is sadly rare. A lot of the times, the management of the company isn't really management. And I'm not picking on any of the other treasury companies. There's a lot of great ones. There really are. But by and large, sub 50 cent Canadian listed companies, generally, management is being led by external forces, and those external forces have the ability to promote and then sell into it. So that's just something to look out for. And again, I think our focus will remain steadfast. I would even say that, where's the best place to hide our capital? Well, if the argument has always been throw your money in the S&P 500, let's just use, for example, the couch potato strategy. So if we're a treasury company, we go, okay, where do we go? We're going to collect our 8 to 10% a year. We'll be safe. We'll make money every year. Well, the S&P, I don't know what it's up this year, 7% or so. Bitcoin's up over 20. If you go back 5 years, I think the S&P has probably doubled in the last 5 years. So let's say it's up 90% or 100%. Bitcoin's up like almost 1,000% over the last 5 years, and on and on and on down the line. So we're going to remain where the value is. You will not see us chase Doge, right? You won't see us chasing. You will see us doing what we, as the largest investors, largest shareholders, and founders, think is right every single time. So there won't be the knee jerk. There won't be the surprises. There will be moves that are made to which we believe are the best for all shareholders.
Love it. That's a good, clear articulation of the unique
And
elements
I
of
don't want to
digital.
knock, and I'm a little negative. I don't want to knock again. There's a lot of great treasury companies in Canada, but as a general rule, if it's a penny stock, be cautious, be careful, do due diligence, and ask around. Because all too often, there's again a CEO, and then it's somebody's deal, right? So just go in eyes wide open and read the MD&A, read the financials, ask the hard questions, call the IR line, email the CEO. It's
It
just
works. It works sometimes. This is proof of that because I contacted Braden and he was open to chatting. And we chatted like a week ago. And yeah, year to date, I just looked it up, 24% in fiat terms, regardless of that's meaningful or not.
BTC, and then what's the S&P? 7%.
Not sure. I don't have a dashboard for that yet.
Okay.
But less than 24%, I can tell you that for sure.
Yeah, I thought it might be 5 or 6%. I'm not sure the exact amount. 5 year, I know it's doubled, so it's 100. BTC is basically 10x in 5 years. So the old argument of kick your feet up, stick the money on a couch potato strategy, which is to say buy the S&P 500. Yeah, you'll make 10% a year, but guess what? Inflation is going to eat six of that, four or five
On
to
the
six.
low end, on the low
Exactly.
end, dude.
And they're going to tell you too, it's more, and then they're going to tax you, and you're going to end up with 2% net of fees and taxes and inflation. And if you think 2% a year beats 25% a year, you're going to get left behind.
Agreed. And to me, the big things that stuck out about Digi were no debt, lean team. After listening to your audiobook, you're experiencing capital markets with the cannabis boom. Your
I would say
openness.
too experienced. Yeah, raised a lot of money, been seen it all. I have seen it all. I'm a good, clean corporate secretary. I'm a good protector of the treasury. I can raise money. I can go out and do these interviews and promote. But first and foremost, I'm an entrepreneur and an authentic guy at heart and a real guy. And I remain humble, even though I have had some success, because it's all relative. And I still consider myself to be a newbie and a student of the markets, even though I have seen a lot in my 20 years of investing.
Love it. I think another thing that really differentiated Digi for me was your openness to just talk with me and to have conversations and to actually hear the input of a, I consider myself a pretty hardcore Bitcoin maximalist. Sometimes it can be fatiguing listen to me go on about why Bitcoin is the only thing that matters, but your openness to receiving input and potentially having me be, more involved with the Bitcoin side of things has really made this way more interesting than any other company I could think of because I've not talked to any other CEO or sensed interest. A lot of them already have Bitcoin strategy officers. But yeah, just your openness really was pretty unique to me. And I think to me as an investor evaluating Bitcoin treasury companies and teams, the three most important things to me are focus, transparency, and flawless high precision execution. And it seems like to me, Digi's moving directionally towards a Bitcoin focus, which, and has a desire to be radically transparent with updates, and is sort of poised to execute a simple playbook, raise capital, buy Bitcoin, repeat, and have, a portfolio of hard assets is the biggest thing. That's really, a focus on having hard assets with the majority being Bitcoin is just a really unique thing. And to be able to join a team and be part owner of a company by buying shares this early on in the journey, as you sort of turn the corner and begin a new phase of the journey, is just super exciting to me. So let's go into shareholder update. So for the last, I don't know how we're doing on time, but it doesn't matter. For the last 21 minutes, I had it set out to just do sort of a shareholder update as a way for anyone who is a shareholder or is considering studying Digi to become a shareholder can kind of know, where Digi's going, what the focus is going to be, what the strategy is to get the company to that place. So I'll hand it over to you. And yeah, if you could just give an update on anything that can be said publicly, and to just give some insight as to what's going on, because a lot's happening, and yeah, it'd be good for people to know.
Awesome. Well, thank you. And thank you for reaching out, because again, every single share matters. The beauty of buying shares in a public company is by proxy, you have a voice. It doesn't matter how many shares, everyone that becomes A shareholder is part of the ownership group and in the owner's box. So I really respect you reaching out. I'm glad you did. And part of the beauty of having a very, very light and effective team is you can bolt in amazing quality value add humans. It's a little difficult when you have a big bureaucratic round table with a bunch of legacy people. So excited to continue to dialogue with you in all capacities. For shareholders, I would say stay tuned. Of course, there are milestones upcoming that we're excited to share and working very diligently on. Things don't happen as quickly as I would like, but we are moving very, very hard with other groups and with other things to bring value in this space specifically, and to really to differentiate ourselves, to be unique, to create a moat, and to easily answer the question for me and for you and for everybody, why Digi? That to me is most important. There's a lot of options. They all are deserving of your time and attention. It's important to understand why you're in something, especially again when markets are so volatile. It's very important that if you decide to be a shareholder, in my opinion, to wade into these things slowly. That is to say, if you have X dollars to buy something, you don't clunk in at once. You slowly step into the water. You learn more, maybe you buy more. You learn more, maybe you buy more. So it is important for me just to share the disclaimer for anyone, whether you're a billionaire or brand new to this business. Start your position slowly, learn as you go. It's a great way to not make mistakes, because if you step into a company at the wrong time and it goes down, you feel like you made a mistake. If you step into a company lightly and it goes down, now it's on sale. Now you can buy more. If you step into a company lightly and it goes up, you can sell and make a short gain and wait for it to come back and buy again if you want to. So stepping in lightly to things while you learn is always prudent. I'm very accessible. So my first name is on here, Brayden at digitalkamaris.com is my email. Our phone number is on the website. It goes to my cell. It's on our deck, the direct line. Anyone can call. I am accessible. I am available on Twitter. I'm available on Instagram, LinkedIn, to a fault, accessible because, again, I'm a retail investor by heart, by nature. I started out at zero. It's important to me that our shareholders do have that access because, again, for me, that's what lets me sleep at night is knowing that if there's a founder of a company telling me to pay attention to his company, it's important that if I have a question that he's responsive and in a respectful time frame as well. So that's what we are working on. As far as the differentiator, I would say stay tuned. I think this component or the media side of the business is arguably a third of the whole equation, which is to say we have to be visible and perpetually updating, and more importantly, explaining our press releases and explaining our news, because all the company has is press releases, and the good companies, in my opinion, they then follow up the press releases with, here's why that matters. Here's what this means. Because the press release, sadly, most people don't even read past the title. And the people that do skim it in about 14 seconds, right? So it's important to me that the dialogue continues. I'd love to make this a regular thing. I'd love to explore alternatives to equity raises. So without sharing anything I can't, because we have warrants at higher prices, and because there's ways to get, I won't say non-dilutive, because there's ways to get non-equity money, aka various loans and things that can go directly towards BTC hard assets, it is to me attractive because it means we won't be going out and raising again. Now, I can't say if we ever do again, but I certainly hope, as the largest shareholder of the company, that we have just raised some capital at 7.5. We have some warrants at 10 cents. If we get through those warrants, we get through the 15 cent warrants. That puts us in a pretty favorable position around how many BTC we own, again, relative to our closest three or four comps in Canada. So the metrics look good. Management, I think, looks good. No debt is very attractive. Lean model is very attractive. We're a blank canvas with respect to we want to plug in to the culture. We want to work with some of the best companies. We are in dialogue with a lot of major known entities, all of which are willing to come on as advisors and take our money in fees to become advisors. So we are assessing different relationships and how accretive that may be to announce partnerships with various groups. That's an ongoing discussion. I have been approached by financial institutions out of New York. I've been approached by financial institutions of Canada. That's unique and rare because I have not seen that since the cannabis mania. I haven't seen banks reaching out to companies since 2016, 2017. It all ended in 2018 when it legalized, ironically. But to say that our inbound engagement is the highest I have seen in the markets in at least 10 years, literally and truly. So that's exciting. That tells me we're doing something right. Branding is everything. I love the name Digital Commodities. There's always room for better branding. There's always room for a nice, sexy dashboard that'll show all sorts of cool metrics. I am working on something like that. I am working on some pretty cool merch. Again, for their engagement, I think having high quality, cool, swag never hurts. I think
Heck
that you
yeah.
just need to have.
Essential.
Yeah, why not? I mean,
That's the
again,
culture.
you're
Where who
exactly.
where are your fighters? It's like I want to be able to wear a Digi hat. And if people ask me,
Totally.
well, what the heck is Digi, to with exuberance explain to them,
Yeah.
what it is and what I understand it to be. And I think probably if we really are trying to hone a community of hardcore hodlers, educated investors who understand it deeply, who are studying it an hour a week, literally, who are up to date on every update and expect transparency and expect focus. It's going to be a hardcore community. I want to be part of helping nurture that community. I would love to do a weekly update with you and a monthly Money Mind podcast. The update will be more specific to what was done in the past week at Digi. The Money Mind will be, I think, broadly exploring different topics related to money, treasury companies, parts of your book. I'm really excited for that. And I'm excited to be able to help with, being in the community. Maybe taking away some of the people who are trying to fight for your attention and give them the updates that lets them feel at ease knowing that they're being updated regularly. Because I think to me, like I said, as an investor, focus, transparency, execution, and signaling that by being available and by putting updates out consistently and showing the work that's being done, I think is part of what makes, I think the markets will reward that. I don't know for sure, time will tell. But I really think the market has rewarded that with what Saylor's doing and strategy. And I think we'll continue to reward that even at a smaller company of a nano cap stock. Maybe even more so, because I think those are the people that really aren't just doing it because, that's what's performed. They're doing it because they probably want to be part of a story more so than just buy a ticker. At least that's my hope. So I'll be available too. Nobody Caribou on X. And I hope to be really involved in digital commodities community and grow that. And yeah, I'm buckled in. I'm really excited.
Well, that's awesome. This is the inaugural convo, one of many more. And yeah, I appreciate you saying that because the it's important to like to Belgravia's credit, to use their name. They've done a really tremendous job on the really messaging, you could say, the pure playness, as it were, with them. So one thing that we will commit to is certainly demystifying for anybody that doesn't understand and honing in on the messaging and being as clear and concise as we can. Because if there's one thing that I have noticed, where the value lies with micro caps, nano sub, dollar companies, is people want access to something very clean, clear, and concise and unique, period. So the more convoluted, the more multifaceted the story is, the less of a reason somebody has to cling on and be a part of. So that I'll work with that. I'll work with you on that. Again, we're accessible. We're open to any and all input within the realms of what we're permitted to do, from a regulatory and exchange point of view. And even also working on that. I mean, to list in Canada and not want to go to the US inevitably would be foolish. So ultimately, our goal would, of course, be to pursue bigger and better things. And it's just making the right decisions down the path today in real time to make sure we're looking at that long term, always long term, but making, again, decisions to stay relevant in the now. So thank you
Cool.
so much for your engagement and reaching out. And I think everything happens for a reason. And again, the companies that are visible and communicating and doing so with all voices, I think are special and are the ones that maybe deserve people's attention.
Agreed. That's probably a good place to wrap. So if you're listening to this, thanks for tuning in to the first episode of the Money Mind podcast. There's lots to do. We have a plan in place for the podcast. Braden has a plan in place for Digi. We're excited to keep everyone updated. So study Bitcoin, study Digi, stack health and sats, and ciao for now.
Thanks, guys.